Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Did you know that as more people listen to WNYC on the internet, our bandwidth expenses go up? Please do your part to support WNYC's online services. Click the ePledge button to make your gift now. And thanks.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
A part of Satchel that no one ever hears about is this part of Satchel. We went over to Drum Island. Drum Island is where they auction off the slaves. And we stood there, he and I, not saying a word, just thinking.
The voice of Negro Leagues baseball great Buck O'Neill, much more than just a ball player. Buck O'Neill died on October 7th at the age of 94. Largely because of the Ken Burns PBS baseball documentary series, Buck O'Neill had become a national icon, a fabulous storyteller, as you heard there, a kind of ambassador for all of baseball, past and present, black and white, a living symbol of history and the ability to overcome without bitterness. Ken Burns says O'Neill became a kind of father figure in his life. Ironically, Buck O'Neill died just after baseball's Hall of Fame rejected him. We are delighted that Ken Burns has agreed to join us to replay some of the classic clips of Buck O'Neill from the 1994 PBS documentary series that brought O'Neill belated national stardom and to remember this unique American. Ken, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, my goodness. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. And what better, could there be anything better to talk about than Buck O'Neill?
And let's just start in with another Buck O'Neill clip, and then we'll talk. In this excerpt, he tells a story about being on the Negro Leagues team, the Kansas City Monarchs, and playing Sunday games that kind of speaks for itself.
It was the era of dress-up. It was that era. See, the men have on ties, hats. The ladies had on their fine dresses. And our baseball, a Sunday baseball, in our faith, you know, Methodist, Baptist, or whatnot, 11 o'clock service on Sunday. But when the Monarchs are in town or when the East-West game was on, they started church at 10 o'clock so they could get out an hour earlier so they could come to the ball game. So they got on their finery coming from church. They came straight to the ball game looking pretty. Yes, we loved it.
Buck O'Neill from the Ken Burns documentary series Baseball in 1994. Ken Burns is with us. Ken, with all the better-known baseball people you were interviewing for that series, how did you first become aware of Buck O'Neill?
Well, my co-producer, Lynn Novick, had traveled to Cooperstown to interview a bunch of old Negro Leaguers who had convened there, I think in conjunction with the annual induction in the Hall of Fame. And there she met and did interviews with a half dozen or more guys. And she came back and said, this one guy, you've got to see it. So the footage came back, and it was Buck, and he just lit up the screen. And we went back to him and back again and again, interviewing him over and over again as we got smarter in our questions and as our relationship with Buck developed and as our interest in making the Negro Leagues and the story of black baseball the kind of central thread and narrative of our series.
Yeah, and I always thought the great thing about your baseball series was that it was never just about the sport in isolation. It was always about how the national pastime reflected the national condition. Did Buck O'Neill exemplify that for you?
Absolutely. I mean, we looked at baseball, and we felt that most of American history sort of focuses too much. When you think American history, it's wars and generals and presidents, a kind of top-down version. Mm-hmm. But we thought that by following a game that had indeed followed us through most of our life as a republic, it opened up many, many more avenues. It's about the exclusion of women. It's about immigration and assimilation. legislation. It's about labor and management, the guys who own the ballpark and the ball and the guys who play the game. It's all sorts of different aspects of American culture that rarely get touched upon in the broad sweep of things. And somehow baseball, this seemingly innocent stick and ball game that accompanies our national narrative, seem to go at the heart of it. And of course, at the heart of America is a story of race. We were born with the notion that African Americans were three-fifths. The guy who articulated all men are created equal owned other human beings. The biggest event in our history, the Civil War, happened because of the existence of chattel slavery. And to my mind, the greatest moment in baseball was Jackie Robinson playing on April 15th, 1947. So for us, baseball was this incredibly challenging prism through which one could see refracted much more than the history of a simple sport. Indeed, you could follow the thread of race, and Buck, more than anyone else, brought that story to us, not with a kind of traditional, either bleeding heart or just superficial consideration of it, but filled with complications, with undertow, with the essence of the bittersweet experience of the Negro Leagues in every way. I mean, he just brought it, willed it alive for us, and what a great gift that was.
And it was funny to hear in that quote how going to the ballpark was an occasion for dressing up in those days. These days, it's an occasion for putting on your sloppies.
Exactly. I mean, we live in such a spurious culture. We don't really know who we are. We're sort of told by our consumer culture supposedly what we should be and what we aspire to. But we found within the African-American community and in the larger baseball community something genuine, something authentic. There's nothing wrong with speeding up that church service or starting it a little bit earlier so you can get out to the ball game, because it was all an understanding of the kind of food, both spiritual and otherwise, that people needed to get by. And the African-American community, which has always been marginalized in our history, put in February, the coldest month, turns out to be, at least to my mind, at the beating heart of who we are. And so I think when you find someone as generous of spirit, as smart, as old, and as encompassing so much history as Buck, then you're looking at someone who is beyond a national treasure.
Ken Burns, my guest on WNYC, remembering the Negro League's great Buck O'Neill, who died this month at the age of 94, who Ken Burns kind of made into a national figure through his documentary Baseball in the 90s. That quote that I read, that you've referred to Buck O'Neill as a father figure to you, did you say that?
Yeah. We became very, very intensely close. He is a generous human being. I mean, I had the great opportunity to deliver a eulogy for him at a memorial service in Kansas City a couple weekends ago.
I read about that.
And I realized, as I was thinking about what to say, that this is the man closest to God who I have ever met, whatever that means.
Wow.
And a lot of it had to do with all of the outer stuff that we celebrate, the ebullient spirit. And, Ernie Banks was there, and Ernie's rightfully celebrated for that optimistic let's play two. You know where he got that?
Mm-hmm.
From the man who scouted, signed, and later coached him, Buck O'Neill. That just essential optimism that Buck made you feel, that he had woken up that day to see you. And he made the thousands of people he met do that. And on top of that, he faced all of this prejudice, all of this rejection, all of these being just a day late and a dollar short rejections, with a kind of magnanimity and grace and eloquence that speaks directly to the Christian ethic. And I found it stunning to meet a person who actually lived what he preached every day, and we became extremely close. My children, then very young, just loved him. I flew to Kansas City when he got sick in late August, and knew when I left him, took him out to lunch, that it was going to be the last time I saw him. And my daughter, who was recently married, drove through Kansas City and went to the hospital the day he arrived for the last time. He entered a hospital a month before he died, and he was admonishing my son-in-law, "Take care of my granddaughter," he said. And I mean, we've just been that close over the years. And yes, I mean, when you have a man in your life that practices that kind of generosity of spirit, you can't help look up at him as a mentor, as a father figure. You know, it's interesting, the first clip that you opened your show, so perfect, about he and Satchel going out to Drum Island. Satchel turns to Buck and says, "I feel like I've been here before." And this sense of carrying with you in your bones, in your fiber of your being, the African-American experience in the United States? And has it made you bitter? Has it made you angry? Has it set you out in the street throwing Molotov cocktails, which could be within your right? No. What have you done? You have worked, and you've loved, and you've reminded people to love, and Buck would end everything as the greatest thing in all my life is loving you.
So I mean, here's another clip where he talks about his relationship as a baseball great in the Negro Leagues with some of the black jazz greats.
We would play ball in the afternoon and down to the auditorium. That night, we would all go down to hear Hampton, Duke Ellington, Fats Waller, huh? The best in the world. We knew them. You know what I mean? Buddy, buddy, we ate together. We slept together. This was actually an exciting era. Yeah, in the United States.
And so, Ken, here you are interviewing him on segregation and all the ills that he had to suffer, and he says this was an incredibly exciting era in the United States.
Absolutely. And you know, you think about it. You've had your, they've moved the church service up an hour so that you can get to the ball game and play two. You can't go to the regular hotel, so where do you go? To the Woodside. Count Basie's greatest tune is Jumping at the Woodside. And who is at the Woodside? Well, it turns out the musicians that are the greatest musicians in the history of this country, greatest composers, you know, Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington. I mean, there's just nobody better than that. And who's there also? Well, Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige, arguably the greatest hitter and the greatest pitcher in the game. So you're looking at the best. You may not be treated as the best, but if something in you knows something, then you have a little bit of extra to get you over those tough things, to keep the wolf at the door. And if you think about it, the improvisation at the heart of the American experience is greater in the African-American community, because if you're owned by somebody else, or if you are suffering from, in later decades, discrimination, unlike your neighbors, well, you have to improvise a little bit differently. So you have to form your Negro Leagues if you're not allowed to play in the Major League Baseball. And you're going to synthesize all the elements you've heard from African polyrhythms of your ancestors through slave songs and Protestant hymns and opera and ragtime and the blues, and you're going to turn it into the most life-affirming, blues-denying thing there is, which is called jazz.
Ken Burns. We'll continue with Ken Burns. We have a lot more Buck O'Neill to hear as well. Ken, stay there. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
Great-grandfather could have been there. See, my great-grandmother could have been there, auctioned off on that block. This was Satchel. This was Satchel. It was a little deeper than a lot of people thought.
The voice of Negro Leagues baseball great Buck O'Neill talking about the great pitcher Satchel Paige. Buck O'Neill, much more than just a ball player. He died on October 7th at the age of 94. And largely because of the Ken Burns PBS baseball documentary series, Buck O'Neill had become something of a national icon because he was a fabulous storyteller, because he became kind of an ambassador for all of baseball, past and present, black and white, and a living symbol of history and the ability to overcome without bitterness. We heard a few minutes ago Ken Burns talking about how they had become very, very close, how Buck O'Neill had become a father figure to him, a grandfather figure to his kids. Ken spoke at Buck O'Neill's funeral or memorial service earlier this month, and will continue to play some of the old clips from the Ken Burns baseball series that brought Buck O'Neill into national fame, and that from 1994 with Ken Burns. And Ken, I guess it's ironic that while you brought him to national fame just before he died, he was rejected by the Baseball Hall of Fame.
It's one of those just, indefensible things. You just can't figure it out how they could possibly have overlooked Buck, and there must be something else going on. But again, Buck was the teacher of us all. I saw him just, it was coincidental, a couple days after the rejection last February. He and I were both getting honorary degrees from an educational institution outside of Kansas City. And we met up, and, I was still in the full throat of fury, as was half the baseball columnists in America and all of his fans around the country. And he was as cool as a cucumber and just said, no, it's all right. And, he then went to Cooperstown, where he should have, to my mind, be the president of the class that got let in of 17 former Negro League players, and some of them owners, including a woman, Effa Manley, who owned the Newark Eagles, which made his exclusion perhaps on the grounds of his batting and baseball records not being spectacular enough. I mean, he easily equals Effa Manley in his role in the history of baseball. We flabbergasted by what had happened. And he went there to the Hall of Fame, to Cooperstown, and gave the most amazing speech, ushering them in. And, then he came back to Kansas City, and it was as if somebody, all the sands just ran out. Just something after he got back, after years and years of being on the road, especially since the baseball series came out and he was in such great demand, suddenly was just tired, and you just suddenly knew, he'd run out of gas.
So here's a Buck O'Neill quote, though, that I read online this morning from just after the rejection. Asked if it hurt him, he said, quote, "I couldn't attend Sarasota High School. That hurt.
Yeah.
I couldn't attend the University of Florida. That hurt. But not going into the Hall of Fame, that ain't going to hurt me that much, no. Before, I wouldn't even have a chance.
Yeah.
But this time, I had that chance," unquote. And that's an amazing quote, because he keeps his eye on what's important, not how he was judged on his ball playing, but that he could be judged equally like anyone else.
That's exactly right. And this is where the greatness of this man. I mean, I remember George Will told me, in the baseball series, at the moment that Jackie arrived, which for us was the highest moment in baseball, and it was very moving to us, and I think that moment in our series was moving. You would have to be the judge. But George Will said, this isn't just a story about sports. This isn't just a story about baseball. This isn't just an American story. This is a human story of almost biblical proportions. And I think that applies to Buck as well. When you meet him, you realize that the forces and the energies that he marshaled in order to do what the rest of us think we can do but can't in those moments. We just recall our own greatest depressions, not lived out in front of the whole world, rejection from the Hall of Fame, but all of our own rejections and the way the degrees of self-pity or whatever depression set in. And to watch Buck not only heal this wound within himself, he was disappointed. I know him well. He was disappointed. But then go out and teach others at the same time a kind of magnanimity. One thinks of Bishop Tutu, of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes, because not just magnanimity, but keeping your eye on the moral ball.
Exactly.
Moral priorities.
There is an amazing tradition in African-American life and therefore in American life that Martin Luther King, of course, exemplifies in our consciousness of this kind of forbearance and tolerance and transcendence that takes place in, for example, nonviolent action. But this goes deeper. It has, as King obviously promoted, a deep spiritual, deep Christian background that I can't pretend to be an expert on. But when I approach it, it's almost as if you've been given, in the midst of the crass commercialism of Christmas, that its true meaning.
I want to,
and the curtains just part for a second, and you go, "Oh my goodness, this is what it's about."
I want to play two more clips of Buck O'Neill side by side here, one and then very shortly thereafter the next one, where he's talking in both cases about the great Negro Leagues pitcher, Satchel Paige, who eventually made it to the majors, after segregation. The first clip is about Page as a baseball player, and then we will hear something a little more about Satchel Paige.
The most outstanding pitcher I'd ever seen. And as an individual, Satchel was a comedian. Satchel was a preacher. Satchel was just about some of everything. He was like, we had a good baseball team. When Satchel pitched, we had a great baseball team. It was just Satchel brought the best out in everybody. And the amazing part about it, he brought the best out in the opposition, too.
Best out in the opposition, too. And Ken, I'll ask you about that quote in just a minute. But then Buck O'Neill goes on to compare Satchel Paige in his effect on the institution of baseball to Babe Ruth.
See, Satchel did to black baseball just what Ruth did to white baseball. See, because Ruth kept the franchises going. This Ruth, after the Black Sox scandal, here comes a Ruth, and he brings it back. And this is the same thing that happened to us. This Satchel came. This is a guy that the people wanted to see, and he never failed.
Clips of Buck O'Neill from the Ken Burns documentary series Baseball back from 1994. We're delighted that Ken Burns has agreed to join us to replay some of those classic clips that brought Buck O'Neill belated national stardom. Buck O'Neill died this month at the age of 94. How about that first one first? Ken, Buck saying that Satchel Paige was such a great pitcher, he brought out the best in the opposition. What do you mean by that? Do you know?
Well, you know, it's true. It's a truism in sports all across the board. You know, the young rookie pitcher who's going to face Roger Clemens or Pedro Martinez, and he has his best day. He might lose 1-0, but you know it's a given that Pedro or Roger are going to give you a Hall of Fame performance, but then the kid rises to the occasion. And I think that's what it was with Satchel. I mean, it's so hard to know for certain, because in a game that's so rooted, so magnificently rooted in facts and statistics, that the sort of impure record keeping of the Negro Leagues makes it impossible. But we think that Satchel won perhaps 2,000 games. I mean, It's just mind-boggling.
And 2,000 games.
Yeah.
And now, just for people who don't know baseball, the best Hall of Fame pitchers are those who win 300 games.
Exactly. And so you're looking at a Titan, Babe Ruth-type character in this. It's you know, every baseball discussion, when you're talking about who's the greatest, you know, I think it's Willie Mays. No, I think it's Joe DiMaggio. Oh, I think it's Henry Aaron. It's Roberto Clemente, whatever it is. It's all assuming, kind of like in pop music. Well, I like the Rolling Stones. I like this. Well, besides the Beatles, besides Babe Ruth. And that's the way it is. And I think in not just black baseball, but in pitching, you in some ways have to set Satchel aside as the very, very best. Five times as many as Cy Young. I mean, this is just an amazing accomplishment for a ball player. So,
how good a ball player was Buck O'Neill?
Buck was terrific. He led his league in hitting, I think, a couple times. He made the All-Star team several times. He was a really good first baseman. But clearly his head was in the game, too, as they say. And he was destined for managing, which he did. And later he became the first African-American coach, third base coach, in 1962 for the Chicago Cubs, where he had already, as a scout, scouted Ernie Banks and Lou Brock and others and brought them along. And we're talking about a Hall of Fame caliber people that he was able to spot.
He also signed as a scout the first black Yankee, Elston Howard.
That's exactly right. And, I mean, he just had his eye out for talent. And, you know, once Jackie arrived, it was the death knell for the Negro Leagues. And they sputtered on for, you know, nearly a dozen years. But they became kind of holding pens for the major leagues. The talent that was developed, because there were still kind of unspoken quotas. You know, one of my favorite baseball statistics comes from the National League, where African Americans were admitted, you know, in a very, very careful basis, one or two per team in the first years after Jackie. And yet African Americans won the MVP in the National League something like 9 out of 11 years, which is a testament to all that had been denied the major league game of baseball by the exclusion of African Americans. So once they burst on the scene, their dominance was so complete and so total. And these players were being picked out of these now sort of diminishing, slowing down Negro League teams. And Buck was the witness of this. And he, of course, got picked up as a scout and then later as a coach.
Did Buck O'Neill
get a chance to be a manager.
Did Buck think that anything was lost by the dissolution of the Negro Leagues in addition to something obviously being gained?
I think he would always emphasize what had been gained, the progress that had been made. But I think the first clips you were playing, which celebrate to me this culture that all of us find as authentically American, that we're drawn to, the best music, the only art form we've ever invented, a kind of real sense of authentic Christianity, a sense of the game being played at its very, very best, all of these diverse aspects of our culture taking place in an African-American community that has had to make lemonade out of all the lemons it's been given by its home people, who are out there promoting to the rest of the world how great we are because all men are created equal. They stood there in the midst of that glaring contradiction and offered something so authentic that, yeah, I think there's something missed. We miss that dressing up. We miss that going to church doubleheader, seeing the Count or Billie Holiday. Buck just loved Billie Holiday. And he said, when I die, you have to play Solitude, the great Duke Ellington piece that is Billie's masterpiece, at my funeral. And I did. People said, oh, no, it's too sad. I said, we're playing it.
Yeah, I heard that the funeral or the memorial service was an occasion for joy as much as for grief in the way people were approaching it.
Do you have a moment? He lay in state all day Friday at the Negro League Museums out in center field, which is there in their enclosed, not to scale park, open casket. 15,000 people came by. The next day, there was a three-hour gospel service at the Bethel AME Church, Buck's church.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. I was so privileged to be there with my daughter, Sarah. The city closed down the city as if the president was visiting. The motorcade from the church to the burial ground to the cemetery was several miles, and every exit of the interstate was closed down as we went along. People were standing outside of cars with their hands over their chests as Buck went by. There was a motorcycle cop, more often than not white, at every alley, at every cross street, as we ran red lights to get to the burial ground. There was a 21-gun salute. Buck was in the service, and a flyover by a Black Hawk helicopter. And later on in downtown at a basketball arena, there was a memorial service where Joe Morgan presided, and Ernie Banks and myself and others and choirs had a chance to sing and celebrate this joyous life. Because I think as much as we were bereft at the absence of Buck, we just also felt this amazing joy that he brought to our lives and to the game and to just the difficulty of living. For all of us, it doesn't have to do with you're black or white or you're Christian or you're not or you like baseball or you don't.
Yeah.
I mean, it's tough to be alive and to suffer things, and he figured out how to get through it.
Ken, I want you to set up this next clip for us. I think this is one that people have never seen on television, that wasn't actually in your documentary, and that we got from your website, I think, as a bonus clip about him and Satchel Paige going to Charleston after playing in Atlanta. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm not exactly sure. I thought that was the Drum Island.
Yeah, we played a little of it before, and we're going to play a slightly longer version of the Drum Island.
Okay.
So here it is.
A part of Satchel that no one ever hears about is this part of Satchel. We in Atlanta. We're playing in Atlanta. The next night, we're going to play in Charleston, South Carolina. So we left that night from Atlanta going to Charleston. And when we get to Charleston that morning, the rooms weren't ready. So he said, Nancy, come go with me. We ride in automobiles. I said, okay. I had an idea where he was going. We went over to Drum Island. Drum Island is where they auction off the slaves during that period. And So he said, come go with me. And so we went to Drum Island. And they had a plaque there, you know, saying what had happened there. And we stood there, he and I, maybe 10 minutes, not saying a word, just thinking. And after about 10 minutes, he said, you know what, Nancy? I said, what's that, Joe? He said, seemed like I've been here before. I said, me too. Because, you know, I know my great-grandfather could have been there. See, my great-grandmother could have been there, auctioned off on that block. This was Satchel. This was Satchel. It was a little deeper than a lot of people thought.
Buck O'Neill and Ken Burns, my mistake, that was, of course, from your documentary.
Yes, yeah. It's really an amazing moment. And I remember in the middle of the gospel service turning to my co-producer, Lynn, and my daughter, Sarah, and just saying, you know, what an amazing thing that these people were picked up from their life, their homeland, and taken by force to a new country. And what would they do, and forced to work, you know, in under brutal, dehumanizing conditions, and what would they do? Adopt the religion of their captors, and then practice a version of it so clean and so pure and so generous as to allow all of the crimes committed in the name of that religion, not the least of which was the unconscionable tolerance of slaveholding, and to just make it better. And it was just something sitting in that small Bethel AMA church in Kansas City the other day that just, it just moved us, rocked us to our foundations. And Buck is going to do that. He's just going to, his half-life is so enormous that he will change things for the better for lives. There'll be a kid who will have a choice to make at one point, black or white, and make the right choice because Buck somehow entered in his life by reading his book or seeing him on a documentary, doesn't really matter, or having had the great good fortune to meet him in person. And, you know, the cliche of what would Buck do isn't a cliche. It's actually true. People say that.
So Buck O'Neill just died this month at 94. By the time you put him on television, he was already 82.
Yeah.
He was already this old man when people came to know him. How do you think your TV series and all that exposure affected Buck O'Neill's life?
You know, it was great. My most cherished story about Buck, I'll share with you. He picked me up at my hotel on my birthday in 1994 in late July. And through some divine intervention, I had been spared the awareness that it was my birthday and all the attendant self-absorption. And he picked me up in Kansas City, and we drove to the airport. We got on the same plane. We flew to Chicago. We talked about what we always talked, and then we split up. He was actually heading on to Cooperstown to be part of that, what was going on in the festivities that summer, and I was going home. And we split up from each other and started to separate. And he called me back, and I went back to him, and he put his arm around me. He said, you know, I've been saying these things for 60 years, and nobody listened towards you. This is an argument we had. And I just said, no, Buck, it's you. You know, you made our film. People listened to our film because you were in it. And I walked away. I got a little bit down the concourse again. He called me back, and I knew this was very important. And he brought me back, and he gave me this big bear hug, and he said, happy birthday, son. I love you. And I have never, ever forgot that. I don't know how he knew it was my birthday. I had forgotten. I don't know how I'd been spared knowing, remembering that it was my birthday, but that was Buck. He was going to take whatever he was given, and he was going to run with it as far and as generously and as lovingly as he could. And I don't know a person who's sort of been in contact with him that hasn't in some ways felt like they've been, had deposited in their account something that made them much richer people.
Ken Burns, thanks so much for doing this tribute to Buck O'Neill with us.
Thank you for spreading it. It's just so important that we remember him and honor him and fight to get him into the Hall of Fame.
The clips from Ken Burns' 1994 documentary that featured Buck O'Neill. Baseball, take care, Ken. Talk to you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.